Tonight we're at Dirt Time 12 up in the hills above Santa Barbara, and we've been here all week practicing primitive skills, fire making, tracking, and so forth. And one of our teachers was Chris Muraski. And where do you live, Chris? Where are you from?
Well, now I'm living down in Torrance, and that's in around L.A. But before that, I was living for about the last dozen years up in Canada, straight north of Spokane, Washington. And so I've only been here since September.
In Southern California. And you've been teaching, really you teach a whole array of outdoor survival skills, really living off the land skills. And what would you'd call them primitive skills, or how would you title what you teach?
I teach people how to live in harmony with the land. That's my focus. I don't really teach survival, and I certainly don't teach wilderness survival, because those aren't concepts that I adhere to.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. And what I want to begin with first, well, I want to get into your background a little bit more, but I was really intrigued by the baking pit that we made today. Everybody dug a hole and we collected certain reeds, but I'd like you to take us step by step through the process of what this was all about.
Okay, so what we did today was we worked together to dig a pit and then get a fire started using a hand drill. And then once we had a good fire going, we put in dry rocks that had no risk of exploding, so that we would be able to build up a lot of thermal mass, a lot of heat in that pit from those rocks.
And the dimensions of this pit, well, we had to use a existing fire pit in the campground, but tell us roughly how big of a pit you would prefer to make serving, say, let's say, 50 people.
To do 50 people, if we had a pit that was 4 feet in diameter, that'd be plenty.
4 feet in diameter, approximately how deep?
And 2.5 to 3 feet.
Okay. So then we got about, what, 24 boulders like grapefruits, approximately, right?
Yeah, grapefruit, some a little bigger, some a little smaller.
Okay.
Yep.
So we made the fire, we put in the rocks, and then tell us what happened after that.
Then we went off and we gathered all of our green material, which was to line that pit. So we were harvesting cattails and also white sweet clover. And then then once we had enough of that, we came back and let the fire burn down so it was just coals, removed the last bits of burning wood from there, leveled out the rocks, and then we laid a bowl, essentially, of cattails into that pit. And it was about 8 inches thick.
Okay. And then we had some collected cattail roots to bake, but mostly we're cooking apples and potatoes to see how the process works. Then what happened once we put all the roots and the garlic and the onions into the pit?
Once we had all of the food in there, then it was time to cover the pit once again. So we put the remaining cattails that we had, so about a third of the total that we collected, went over the top of it. And in the old days, we would have used sheets of bark, or we could have harvested large leaves to wrap individually the food that went into it. Just to be expedient, we just used a sheet to cover the pit.
Okay, and so then we covered the sheet with soil that was there, and I noticed you were watching it very carefully. You wanted to make sure no steam was coming out, right?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that there was no steam coming out, so it's about 3 inches of soil that we put over top of it, and then it's just a matter of keeping tabs on smelling it and feeling underneath the soil and using quite a bit of intuition to know just how everything's going inside of there.
So we stopped and then came back, what, 2 hours, 3 hours later?
Well, I guess the first time we really checked on it was a bit over an hour, and then we ended up opening up the pit about 2 hours after we had closed it.
And describe that opening to us.
So we scraped off all of the dirt, or most of it, from those sheets, and then we lifted off everything, the rest of the soil with the sheets, and then huge cloud of steam, very, very hot.
It was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so
I mean, I was standing where all the steam was coming out. It was like being in a sweat bath or something.
Yeah, so then the tricky part is reaching into the middle of the pit and pulling everything to the outsides without actually dragging any of the soil over the food. And everybody did a beautiful job. So they opened it up, everything was perfectly cooked and really flavorful. It just mixes all of those awesome flavors together.
Yeah, I think some of the potatoes and things had a bit of the flavor of the clover, the sweet clover. That was really interesting. And some folks might think I've cooked in a fire. I've wrapped things in tinfoil. There's no tinfoil for this, folks. It's right on the cattails, and then it's covered, and then it's just let to let to sit for a while. Does this have a tradition in like the Hawaiian fire pits, or what is this a specific tradition that you do and that you teach?
I wouldn't say that I follow any particular tradition with it, because the pit baking is used in many, many places around the world. But the cool thing about it, the hot thing about it, is that it's so functional. It has so many applications. And I've made this. I've made a lot of pit bakes over the last 20 or so years. And at one point, we pit baked 3/4 of a moose. And there's some foods, some of the native foods that we'd be harvesting, like camas or arrowleaf balsam root or the agave hearts. Those need to be baked in that slow, long-term, moist heat for a long period of time, like 3 days.
Those foods that you mentioned really wouldn't be edible, would they, if they were just boiled, for example?
That's right. Boiling won't do it. Even roasting them over the coals won't do it.
Yeah.
It's that long-term moist heat.
Yeah.
And when you take that stuff out and the meat just falls off the bones, and the agave hearts and the camas, they've converted all of the starches into fruit sugars, and they're just absolutely delicious.
Yeah, I could tell people were very excited when the cover came off, because there was one man that said he didn't think this was going to work, what we were doing. But they were all excited. Everybody was trying, you know, the apples and a little bit of the garlic and chewing the cattail roots. Yeah, it was really cool. So I want you to describe for us, if you will, what you mentioned that you were living in Canada, and how did you get into teaching these skills? I'm curious what your beginnings were.
Well, I grew up, I haven't really grown up, but when I was young...
Right, that's not like me.
When I was young, anyway, I was living in Michigan, and I lived 30 miles outside of Detroit, so it wasn't like I grew up in the wilderness, but my father was one of the most competent outdoorsmen I've ever met, and we took off for the woods every opportunity that we had. And he worked as a school teacher, so he had his summers off just like I did. And it took me many years before I realized that the way that I learned to be in the woods was very different from the way other people spend their time in the woods. When we hiked through the woods, we whispered when we communicated.
You and your father whispered to each other?
Yeah, yeah.
And why did you do that?
Well, because we wanted to see what was out there.
I see.
So when people walk down the trails and they're talking in their normal city voices, everybody knows that you're coming. All the deer, all the squirrels, everything.
And they run.
Alerted. Well, they run or they hide.
Yeah.
And so I just naturally learned, move through the woods quietly. Move through the woods in a silent, flowing movement. And
that's something that even city folks should learn, really, if
yeah.
you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you're less aware if you're just boisterously walking along, talking randomly, not paying attention to your surroundings.
And when I first was hunting deer by myself, the first year that I was rifle deer hunting on my own, my dad and I, we hiked off into the woods to a place that we had selected a couple of weeks beforehand. And so we hiked out way before daylight and got to the base of this tree where I was going to be sitting and watching a couple of deer trails. And my dad said, now you sit there and don't move, and I'll come back and get you after dark. I think I was 11 years old.
Huh. And dark was how many hours away?
We're 11, 12 hours away.
Really?
Yeah.
And you did that?
And I did that. I did it that day, and I didn't get a deer, and so I did that again the next day. And
so you sat there with a rifle waiting for a deer to come by.
Yeah. 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 So I learned how to meditate through deer hunting.
Well, that's a very interesting beginning story. Isn't that more of the traditional style of Native American hunting? It's more stealth and just a lot of waiting along the right place for the deer to come by or the animal to come by?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the way that is easiest to get close to animals, and by sitting still, the woods kind of forget that you're there, and all of the animals come around, and suddenly it's amazing, all of these animals that that most people don't even realize are there.
They start coming out, yeah. So you were, what, 11 years old then?
I was 11 then.
And then did your father continue to teach you other skills like fire making and so forth?
Well, he really knew the bush skills from the modern standpoint. So he was fantastic at reading animal sign, and he was really good at setting up camp and tying knots and wilderness first aid and all of those kinds of skills. It was the Stone Age skills that was my special interest that he really couldn't help me with.
So you like to call it Stone Age skills versus wilderness, outdoor, survival, or anything like that?
Right, right. Well, if we look at our ancestors, and regardless of where you come from, if you go back far enough in our ancestry, everybody did the same thing. Everybody was chipping rocks and throwing sticks.
In other words, it doesn't matter where you came from.
Exactly.
We all did the same thing at one time.
Exactly, yeah. And so when I look at those people and the way that they related to the land, they didn't think that they were in a survival situation. They were just living.
They were just living their life.
Yeah. And with enough competence, with enough skill, it's not a challenging thing 99% of the time.
Yeah.
And I don't call it wilderness survival, because wilderness means that it's a place that we don't know very well.
I see.
And often it's a scary place. And
so you want the wilderness essentially to be home. So we're
exactly.
not thinking of it as some distant, far away thing.
Exactly. I have a really big backyard.
Okay. Is that? Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. So, tell me how you began to learn some of these other skills. Did you just get books or find teachers, or what did you do?
A lot of it was me just figuring things out on my own. I've read tons of books. When I was 11 years old, and I had read in the Boy Scout field guide how to start a fire with a bow drill set, and I thought, oh, that is so cool, I got to do that.
And that's a very scanty description, isn't it?
There's almost nothing to it.
Yeah.
But I was in Boy Scouts, and there was a Wilderness Survival Merit Badge, and so I contacted the only two Wilderness Survival Merit Badge instructors in my area, and I said, can you teach me how to do this? And neither one knew how to do it. The one guy said, I don't know how to do it, but I'll try to figure it out with you. And we made a set, and we got smoke, but we never got a coal.
Really?
And it took me 2 years of trying to figure it out before I got my first coal that way.
Wow. Are you aware that, I don't know if they do this anymore, but at some of the Boy Scout supply places, you can actually buy a kit for making fire with a bow and a drill.
Yeah. Things.
I once bought one for one of my brothers for a Christmas gift, and he said, what are you giving me this for? I thought it was a great gift. The bow wasn't great. The drill was great. And the little block at the top was really good. So how did you actually go about it in those 2 years? How did you actually figure it out? Just trial and error?
Well, I made a number of different bow drill sets. I made them from different materials, but mostly I just went into my dad's wood pile, and I knew that I needed a board. I needed a fire hearth. And so I looked for something that was already a board, because that would make my life easier, which most of those were pine, which is not a great material most of the time.
Right.
And finally, after 2 years, and I didn't know how to identify most of the trees around me, I got a list of the woods that supposedly worked well to make a bow drill kit, and I showed it to my dad, and I became humble, and I said, Dad, can you show me these? Do we have any of these? And he said, yeah, we got a chunk of cottonwood there. And
where'd you get the list that told you what woods are good?
I don't remember where I saw that list from.
Yeah.
But I split out a kit out of cottonwood, and it took me about an hour before I had my first fire.
Yeah, and how'd that feel that day?
It was a long time coming, but it was very rewarding, because nobody handed it to me.
Right. So, besides the bow and drill, have you learned about all the other fire-making methods?
There's a lot of fire-making methods. I wouldn't say that I've learned all of them, or that I'm particularly skilled in all of them, but that first fire was 30 years ago.
Okay.
So I consider myself to be very, very competent. I know that under almost any circumstances, I can get a fire going.
Yeah. And do you prefer to teach your students the bow and drill method?
I don't, actually. I prefer to do hand drill, but I do teach both bow drill and hand drill, because they're good in different circumstances. And it's good to have that flexibility to be able to jump from one to the other.
Okay, and then at some point, I presume you weren't taking sleeping bags into the woods. How did you acquire those skills? What was the process as it played out?
Well, there were times when I would reach a point where I thought my skills were pretty good, and then I'd go and test them, and normally I'd learn a little more humility.
I see.
So there was definitely a lot of trial and error as I was learning things.
I can just remember that sometimes a big part of it was just being able to put up with the cold, you know, learning to realize that this is the way it's going to be. But did you practice making lean-tos or fire beds, or what would, tell me some of the things that you did in learning how to, because for some people this would be frightening, go in the woods with no sleeping bag, no tent. So what were some of the things that you did, and what was going through your mind when you did them?
Well, lots and lots of things. I guess I was always practicing.
Okay.
And some things, like I'd made a fire with a bow drill kit, so I'd make another fire with it, and then I'd make a new kit. I'd try different woods. I would try it in different circumstances. I would try taking my kit and dunking it into a bucket of water and then see if I could get a fire with it.
So you like to experiment a lot.
I was, yeah, and it was just me trying to understand things more. And then I would go out and I'd put those skills to the test as I'm trying to learn more about how to be with the land rather than just walking through the land. And like when I was, oh, I guess I was 17, and I had started a lot of bow drill fires, and I had done a fair amount of practicing these skills outside. And I thought I was going to go 2 weeks into this wilderness area in central Michigan, which is called it's a beautiful place called the Dead Stream Swamp.
Okay.
And so I canoed.
What time of year was this?
It was August.
August.
Life should have been easy.
Okay.
And so it was an area that I had to canoe into, and I canoed into it, and from this beautiful sunny blue sky, the clouds rolled in, and it just dumped down rain. And it rained solid for 4 days.
You stayed out there?
I stayed out there. I built a shelter, and when
what kind of a shelter did you build?
Well, in this case, I just wanted to build something quick because it was raining.
Just to get out of the water,
just to
of course.
Just to do it. So I took my canoe and I tossed that over a log, and then I built up the sides and
okay.
with bracken fern and just covered it with bracken fern and leaves and whatever else I had for debris there.
Was that sufficient to shed the water?
And that worked great.
Yeah. Okay.
So I had a shelter which was very functional but not incredibly spacious, and now my main pursuit was get a fire going so that I could be totally dry, and then I could go off and forage, and even if I got wet, I could still dry off. So when the rain sort of was at a drizzle at one point, I went out and tried to gather materials. And
materials for what?
Materials for making a fire kit.
Okay.
So I was going to make a boat.
So
drill
you
set.
Went there basically with nothing.
I didn't have much, I did have a real light sleeping bag with me, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah, no and knife?
No, I actually did have a knife with me,
okay,
too.
Okay, good.
And so I went out, and I found some wood that seemed like it was pretty dry, and I came back, and I carved it into a fire kit, and I started working with a bow drill set, and I got lots and lots and lots of smoke, and then I would burn through the board, and I'd carve a new notch, and I'd go at it again, and I'd get more and more smoke, and I'd burn through it again. And in 4 days, I could not start a fire. And that was when I was 17, and I realized, wow, I really don't know hardly at all what I thought I knew.
Well, a little bit of adversity, and it tests what you know, right?
Yeah.
Everything
yeah.
is good under ideal circumstances.
Yeah.
So you had already, by age 17, learned about a lot of the edible wild plants?
I knew a lot of what I could forage for out there, but in this case, because I couldn't get a fire started, I didn't go out and forage
uh-huh.
because I had no way to dry off, and I would just be too cold.
So what did you do in that case? Go home?
Well, for 4 days, I stayed in a little shelter, and I just toughed it out and learned humility.
Yeah, that's a big lesson. A lot of people never learn that one.
Yeah, it was a
that's
huge
good.
Lesson,
yeah, yeah.
And I was ripe for it.
Yeah.
And then after 4 days, the sun came out, and I realized I was totally whooped.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And
well,
I went home.
Yeah, okay, well, I've had things like that. I know what you're talking about. But your botanical study, how did you pursue that? Just with books, or did you have teachers or botany classes? What did you do along those lines?
When I was a kid, I think I almost memorized Peterson's Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants.
Okay.
And I picked up, you know, books by Bradford Angiers,
right,
and
right.
You know, went through and learned all of the plants that I possibly could, and experimented with all of the different ways of preparing them that are written up in the books.
And this was in the eastern U.S. again.
Yeah, yeah. This was Michigan and then Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And so I learned a lot. I learned that actually there's a lot of plants that are listed as edible that are not particularly good.
Right, it says edible, but you learn by doing it.
That's right, yeah. And
Now, just as a curiosity, why do you think so many authors are wrong? They'll say such and such is edible. Do they just not know how to prepare it, or what?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on there. One is that their focus is on what's edible rather than what tastes good. And then there's the dangerous part, which is a lot of people that are writing books on edible plants, they're trying to make a real complete listing, but they haven't necessarily tasted and done all of those plants themselves.
Right.
And there's too much of a risk of some of those folks just copying information from other books.
Yeah.
And I've particularly seen that with one plant, which is the pond lily, the yellow pond lily. And Peterson's Field Guide says that you can eat the roots, and you can't.
But is that all it says, you can eat the roots?
It doesn't go into a big description of
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they collected the information somewhere. So that's good. Did you take botany classes also, or have mentors or teachers who guided you?
I did. I've got a degree in wildlife biology and management, and I did take botany in college. And then I also, you know, anytime there's somebody who knows some things that I can sit in on their class and I can learn from, I love to do that. So it's actually been really fun coming out here, because I wanted to attend some of your classes, Christopher.
Well, I'm glad. I hope you learned something. This was very sparse out here. How about some of the other instructors?
Well, Tom Elpel's a good friend of mine, and I met up with a really fantastic herbalist from McCall, Idaho, and then some of the native people that I've hung out with, an herbalist from northern Vancouver Island, where I learned some skills from her. You know, it's a little bit here and there.
Yeah. Now, you said at some point today that you lived in the Lakota lands for a while. When did this occur, and what did you do there?
Well, I've traveled around to a lot of different reservations and spent some time here and there with Lakota and Blackfeet and Crow and Shoshone Arapaho and down into Mexico with the Seri. And
you just invited yourself, or how did this work?
Well, I really believe in listening to inner guidance. And at one point, I was still really young. I had just gotten out of college, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I just felt like I didn't really want to work that particular summer.
Yeah.
I had some money saved up, and I realized at one point I just wanted to travel west.
Yeah.
And I was living in the Midwest. I'd never been out to the Western states, and I wanted to go west and go and visit Indian reservations.
Yeah.
And as soon as I made that decision, within a week, I ran into an old man who had in Ohio, and he had been living for parts of the last 20 years with Crow and Lakota. And so he explained to me some of the social customs to be aware of, so that I was courteous while I was there. And also he said, you know, go and visit this person and that person, and go to this gathering and that gathering. So he gave me a handful of contacts to begin with.
That's good.
Yeah, so that was really nice, because I could just show up and say, hey, you know, David sent me, and I was immediately welcomed into a family. But there was a lot of other places where I would just go to the reservation and I would sit down, and it'd be no time at all before somebody would come by and they'd say, hey, what are you doing here?
And then what? They'd invite you home or something?
Well, pretty much.
Yeah,
I would just
yeah.
say, you know, I'm out here to learn as much as I can of the old ways. And they'd go, oh, well, you should come with us, because, you know, we're going to go and do a sweat.
Yeah.
And it was always that easy for me, but I was by myself. So
in many ways, when you went to the reservations, you really, because people, you know, they're living modern ways for the most part, but would you say that you were learning mostly some of the ceremonies and that way of life? Tell me what new things you learned when you went to the reservation lands.
It was social, cultural, and ceremonial, and really nothing at all or hardly anything at all about the practical living skills of being in harmony with the earth by virtue of what we do.
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, I was invited a number of times to teach either the adults or their children some of the old-time skills.
Yeah, yeah. And did you do that?
I did, yeah. Yeah. Well, I was on the Rosebud Reservation, and that's Lakota. And I started a fire. In that case, I started a fire with a bow drill, and it was they had a youth camp there. And so started up the fire, and there were two old men there. They're both probably in their 80s. And the one guy says, "Oh, that's really neat. You know, I've never seen that before. I've heard of that. I've never seen it."
Yeah.
And then he pulls out a lighter and he says, "I just go like this."
Yeah. Well, you know, people don't realize that it is almost like third world conditions in some of the reservations, and these folks are not, you know, they're trying to survive, like anybody.
It's not Dances with Wolves out there.
It's not Dances with Wolves, right.
Yeah, and Pine Ridge, when I was there, was 97% unemployment. I can't imagine.
97?
97, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Can't imagine. It's much different.
Wow. So to skip around a little bit, I noticed today when you were here at Dirt Time that you were weaving this cornucopia-shaped basket for catching fish or crawdads. You're a really good weaver, and you went down to the river. I saw you cutting willows. I saw you carefully split them, and while various classes were going on, you slowly were weaving it around and around. How did you learn how to weave?
Well, I've had the benefit of sitting in the footsteps of some very talented weavers, and so I've been very blessed in that sense of I can count as friends a lot of people that are very skilled in things where they've specialized. And I'm not a specialist, I'm a generalist, so I've learned from a lot of people. And it's also a feel. So after spending a long time living in the woods and doing these skills, there's a feel of when the willow bends a certain way, when the fire, when the spindle and the fireboard makes a certain sound. You know, there's a lot of sense that goes into knowing when it's right, when it's all coming together well, that goes beyond, yeah, this looks good.
Yeah, yeah. So in other words, after long hours of hard work and practice, there's a certain intuition that takes over.
Absolutely.
But still, so you learned how to weave because you happened to run into various masters, or you sought them out? How did you, you know, there are specific techniques to doing it all, and how did you acquire those skills?
Well, I'm a bit of a throwback, so this isn't my first time around the block here, so a lot of the skills that I'm doing are things that I remember, and I'm relearning them as opposed to just trying to figure them out the first time. And also,
so you're feeling that it comes kind of natural to you.
It does come very naturally to me.
Yeah.
And of course I have flipped through enough books where I've seen twining techniques for making baskets and that. I haven't made that many baskets, but when I sit down and want to make a basket, I know that I can.
Yeah, well, you were methodical and slow and not trying to throw it together in a hurry, and it's a beautiful basket, I must say. It looks really good. A lot of people have come up and admired it. Besides that style, are there other woven type things that you have made?
Well, I've made a willow backpack, and I've made various baskets, and I will do some finger weaving on occasion where I'm making straps, belts, that sort of thing. It's a nice meditation. It's a nice way to make something.
I noticed that you were also that you're wearing some kind of buckskin today. Is this something that you made yourself?
It is, yeah. I've got brain tan buckskin that I've tanned up myself, and it's dyed with walnut hulls. And I haven't killed all of the deer that went into this this clothing, but some of them I have.
But let's say somebody has they know Indians wore skins, but if you skin the deer off of an animal, let it sit somewhere, it becomes real hard and stiff. What do you actually do? Talk us through briefly the process of how you took that from an animal skin and turned it into you know, it feels pretty soft and comfortable.
Yeah, yeah, and it wears like iron too. This this clothing is about 12 years old.
Really?
Yeah. So what I do is I will take the hide and I'll lay it over a smooth log, and I'll scrape off all of the meat and the fat, and I'll use a metal scraper blade, but I could use a leg bone.
Okay.
And then I will soak that hide in either wood ashes, that's the old-time method,
okay,
or I'll soak it into hydrated lime,
okay,
which is kind of the new way of doing it. And what that does is the glue inside the hide becomes soluble, and it can be rinsed out of the hide, so then the hide is much less able to become hard once again.
Okay.
And once I've done that, then I scrape off all of the hair and the thin layer of epidermis underneath that hair, and then I'm down to a suede leather. And so then
it is like suede.
It is a suede, yeah. Buckskin is suede leather.
Yeah.
And so, because we remove that epidermis, the grain layer.
Yeah.
And then I take that hide and I will put it into a solution of brains. So it really is brain tanning with the brains.
Uh-huh.
And so I boil the brains first. I will either squish the brains up, or I'll make a brain milkshake and do it with a blender.
Okay.
And then I get it so that it's hot, but where I can still put my hand in it and be comfortable.
Okay.
And then I'll put the hide in and stretch the hide inside there, take it out, wring it out really thoroughly, and that opens up all the fibers. And then I will stretch it and tug it and work it until it's dry.
And then it becomes soft and supple at that point?
It's soft, supple, it's brain tan, it's buckskin, but at this point it's going to be pure white. And if I get it wet, it'll stiffen up some. So in order to set that hide and make it permanent, then it's smoked. That gives it a nice brown color.
Okay. And how did you learn how to do that? Was that just trial and error or what?
There is definitely some trial and error in the beginning there, because the first four hides that I did, somebody had told me that they had heard of somebody who knew of somebody whose brothers, sisters, uncles, cousins, aunt used to tan hides, and they used lime.
Okay.
Or not lime, no, they said they used lye.
Lye, right.
And so no idea how much to put into the water that I soaked the hides into. So I soaked my hides in a lye solution, and I basically, the hides were eaten.
Okay.
So I ruined my first
again,
four
you're
hides.
Learning. You're learning by
yeah.
experience.
Yeah.
And then did you get a pattern to make? You have like a shirt and a coat. Did you follow some pattern, or you just made it intuitively?
I just made them intuitively.
Yeah.
No
yeah.
pattern.
Yeah, that's really cool. So that brings another question. So you used to hunt with a rifle. Do you still use a rifle, or how do you hunt when you're out looking for meat?
I will sometimes take a rifle out if I'm just wanting to be quick and practical about it, because sometimes I get kind of busy, and I know that I can take a rifle out, and I'm in a new area now, but where I used to live, there, I always knew that I could head out in the morning and I could get a deer and I could be back by the afternoon.
With a rifle?
With a rifle.
Uh-huh.
But with a bow, that changes everything. You
yeah.
really have to be much more intimate and spend a lot more time out there, which there have been times in my life where I had all that time, and I love that. But sometimes I go out with a bow. I make my own bows, make my own arrows, you know, stone points, and tie it on with sinew and the whole bit.
What's your preferred wood when you make a bow?
I don't know that I have a preference, but the bow that I'm using right now I really enjoy, and that one's out of black locust.
Black locust. There's some of those trees actually growing in this campground.
Yes. Yeah.
And arrows are made out of what?
Arrows, most of my arrows right now are still made out of red osier dogwood, which we have up in Canada, and I don't have that down here, so
yeah.
I'm probably going to be making my arrows out of either toyon or rose.
Okay. Yeah, rose was one of the preferred ones down here. How long would it take for you to make a bow?
If I really needed a bow and I just needed a bow quickly, I'm sure that I could be hunting with one tomorrow.
Oh, really?
If I start in the morning, I can be hunting with it the next day.
Now, when you teach a class, you're teaching all the various classes that you've taught throughout the country. Do you have students learn how to capture animals or collect birds or meat in some way?
I like for students to learn trapping techniques. And so, and they do set up their traps so that they're learning how to do it. And I don't really care if they want to set it up so the trap has a couple of rocks underneath it and it only comes down so far, but I want to have it set so that an animal can trip it and they know whether their trap is working effectively.
What kind of traps are you teaching these days?
For me, what I prefer is there's two styles of traps that I, well, three styles that I really like. The Paiute deadfall trap, okay. That is the, in my opinion, that is the most effective trap that you can make in an area where there's enough flat stones to make it practical.
Right. And for those who don't know what that is, you can look in any books. Larry Dean Olson's book, there's many others. But it's you need some weight, and you have a figure four, but one side is a string.
Yep.
So it's an ingenious method of a deadfall.
It is, and it's a very, very sensitive trap. There was one time where I was living in southeast Idaho, and I had pack rats that got up into the roof of the house I was living in, and I just went into a hardware store and bought a couple of commercial rat traps to catch these critters out of there because they sounded like elephants on the ceiling.
Really?
And I set the traps every night, and the pack rats would just steal the bait. And so finally I said, forget. So I went and I got a big 15, 20-pound rock, carried it up into the ceiling, and then I caught the pack rats.
With a Paiute trigger?
With a Paiute deadfall trap, yeah.
Interesting. So that's one. What are the other styles that you teach?
The other two would be a spring pole snare and an Arapuka-style bird trap.
Okay, try to describe those as best as you can for people listening.
Okay, so the snare is set up where when the animal goes through the snare and it's closed around the animal's neck, when they feel that, they panic and they'll jump, and that pulls out a hook, essentially, that's made from a forked stick that is attached to a bent-over branch.
Okay.
So they pull that loose and it lifts the animal up.
So if the animal is at the wrong place at the wrong time, or the wrong place at the right time,
yep,
it gets caught in the string.
Yes.
Yeah. And the, what'd you call it, Arapuka?
Arapuka.
I always call that a quail trap.
Yeah.
Describe it for us.
Well, the difference between the California quail trap and an Arapuka bird trap is in the trigger mechanism.
Oh, okay.
And I like the Arapuka style, but both of them are totally effective. And essentially, it's a box trap, but it's made with sticks.
So it looks like a log cabin, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's just it's a way to catch a bird alive.
Yeah.
But in an area like where we are now, there's lots of scrub jays, and they're very curious. And if you have anything that looks like food, they're going to come down and investigate it. And if it actually is food, they'll peck away at it until finally they'll go under the trap and knock loose the sticks, and then the trap comes down.
So, okay, so it's a box suspended by a very tenuous trigger mechanism with some cords, and so the bird goes in, and the bird goes in because you've baited it, right?
Right.
What do you bait it with when you're out in the backcountry?
Well, in this area, what I like to do is I listen for and I look around where the acorn woodpeckers are, because the acorn woodpeckers, they've stored away their acorns. And then I'll go and I'll get a handful from them.
Okay, go steal some acorns from the woodpeckers. Okay.
Yeah, and then mash those up a little bit so there's chips and pieces laying around, and that's plenty of good attraction for the scrub jays.
Good. So I know that you're going to be doing some classes in Southern California. I saw a poster for a three-day. What was it called? A three-day.
It's
wilderness
a
experience, what'd you call it?
It's a three-day Stone Age adventure.
Okay. And talk me through. Let's say I'm a new student with you, and what's going to happen the first day? What am I going to do? What am I going to be exposed to?
Well, the first thing that we start with is actually awareness, because most people, well, really everybody, we spend too much time around things that deaden our senses because there's so much sensory overload in society. So we get away from that and we get into sensory expanding exercises and deepen our intuition skills, and then we learn how to walk silently, completely changing the way that we step on the ground and changing the way that we look around us. So so that we're taking in more of what's around us.
So this you have to do this with not a really a large group, right? You have to have kind of a small group.
Yeah, it's a small group.
So you're training people first just to be aware of their surroundings, and you're going to start in the morning, I presume.
Yes.
And then what do you do for night and for food?
We do some harvesting, for sure. We cover a lot of different edible and medicinal plants and the processing of those. And then we're also setting our traps and snares. We're learning tracking. We're learning two or three different Stone Age fire-making methods.
Okay.
We're learning Stone Age cooking techniques. We pack the days, so there's a ton of information.
Now, if I was a new student, do I have a bring list of things? What do I actually bring with me? Do I take a sleeping bag, for example?
I tell everybody, bring whatever you need to be comfortable with. So bring a tent, bring a sleeping bag, bring a teddy bear. All those things are good.
Okay, teddy bear's okay. Okay.
And
so they're not going to be required to sleep in a hole for the first night out.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not interested in finding out how tough anybody is, because our ancestors, they were in relationship with the land because they had so much skill and so much appreciation for being in harmony.
Yeah.
So that's my approach. Yeah. I want people to learn the skills and learn the attitude so that they can live comfortably without all of the technological gear. So bring it to begin with, and then we learn how to get rid of those things as we go.
I see. Well, that makes sense. It's safe. And are you cooking without modern utensils, like on rocks, or how are you doing the cooking?
We're doing a mix of that. So our first day, first night, for instance, I just finished up with a six-day intensive. And the second night on that six-day intensive, we did corn roasted over the coals in the husk, and then we did shark and stingray that my son and I had gone and spearfished. We did those over the coals as well.
Really? And you do it like the fire bed that you made here today?
Yep, we just have a really good fire going and then burn it down to coals, and that's really the best way to do it.
You know, I want to add a little interesting story. When we were all talking the first day of dirt time, this man came by with his son, and they had all this bag of crayfish, and everybody was pretty impressed. They saw this one guy has this hide shirt on, and the son is shirtless with a bag of food already. And that turned out to be you. We hadn't met you yet, and you said, "Oh, I'm one of the teachers," and everybody was really impressed at your son. How old is your son?
He is 14.
And so he's really quite a hunter already in his own right. He's brought back fish and crayfish, and you're his teacher, obviously.
He grew up learning how to walk on dirt. So he was born not in a teepee, but that's pretty much where he was living pretty soon after that. And he's learned the skills because that was the way that he was brought up.
Yeah, I'm impressed with the way he's gone about things. Does he go with you on your classes that you teach?
Sometimes he does.
Yeah.
He's 14. He likes girls now.
Yeah, well, I understand. Hey, so how do people reach you, Chris?
The best way to reach me is to go to www.meetup.com/ancient-pathways. So, or you can look up Ancient Pathways of SoCal, or you can just look up my name. My name's scattered over the internet.
Spell the last name.
So the last name is MoraSky.
Okay, and of course, people who are viewing this online or listening to this online, see my website. If they want to get a message to you, they can send it to me. I'll make sure you get it. Do you have any books or anything like this in the works or that you're planning on producing?
I do have both books and videos that are in the works. We were just up in the San Gabriels not too long ago, and we were filming a Stone Age fishing video. So catching trout by hand and making our fishing line, making our hooks.
Whereabouts in the San Gabriels?
That's a secret.
Oh, it's a secret. Okay. I know I've asked you that before, and that's fine. That's fine. How did you go about catching them by hand? That may sound very mysterious and impossible to most people.
Right. Well, trout are creatures of habit, and so they know where all the holes are. They know where the good hiding places are, and so I'll walk up to a pool and I'll just watch where the fish go.
Okay.
And then I will simply slip into the pool and I'll go to where I saw those fish go.
Oh, you'll walk into the pool.
Yeah.
That's not going to spook the fish?
Well, the fish are already spooked, and they've gone into their hiding places, but they'll tend to go to their hiding places in the pool rather than taking off way upstream or way downstream. They stay close.
I see.
And then I just slowly reach my hand up under the bank, around rocks, and they're used to having bits of seaweed and other fish bump into them.
Uh-huh.
As long as I move very, very slowly, I can reach in and feel those fish, feel along the body of the fish and it's tickling the trout until I get to where I've got him by the middle of the body, and then just grab the trout.
Interesting. Is there anything I should be concerned about if I'm reaching around in the water under a rock? Is there any problem things that might get me?
Not in this area. Yeah. There's other areas where you might run into a snapping turtle or a beaver.
I see.
That'd make life exciting.
So I really find that fascinating. I know in the Sierras there are these narrow streams that run everywhere, and there's little, you can walk along them and see the holes in the opposite bank, and you could work with the partner and just pick the fish out. So I think it's a bit more challenging up in these mountains. And we're San Gabriel's folks are the mountains. You know, the Angeles National Forest is the northern one-third of L.A. County, so it's these mountains above L.A. And what other animal procurement methods might you use in these hills?
Well, I love setting the Paiute deadfall trap and the spring pole snare, and then also the Arapuca bird trap.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking for pack rats and mice and cottontail rabbits and scrub jays. You know, those are animals that I'd try to find.
Yeah. Well, look, I had a great time talking with you, and I really hope people listening to this have an opportunity to contact you, maybe ask you some questions. There's a lot of folks who are not online. Is there just a mailing address that they could write to or a phone number? Do you have anything like that?
I can give them my phone number.
Yeah, go ahead.
Phone number is 310-375-1671.
We got a lot of screaming in the background here, so give it to us one more time.
310-375-1671.
Thanks, and thank you so much for taking your time, Chris.
My pleasure. Thank you, Christopher.
All right. Get this off.